Disclaimer: this content is meant for information only and not as a diagnosis or medical treatment for any condition. If you or a loved one needs help, please seek out a qualified medical professional for assistance. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Katie Oshta, BSN, RN, IBCLC, and infant feeding specialist. Quench your thirst for knowledge and travel with me across the nation to discover, learn, collaborate, and better serve clients from all over the globe. Let's ride and thrive together. Today on the podcast, I have Rosa Suarez. Rosa is an IBCLC in private practice in Barcelona since 2008. She is a computer engineer working on internet and databases since 1986. In 2002, after her first daughter was born, she and her husband created CrianzaNatural.com, a Spanish portal and forum for information for attachment parenting style of life. Since then, she has been involved in breastfeeding groups such as the Leche League and Areola, in which she still collaborates with. She offers breastfeeding and baby wearing education in Spain, Portugal, Poland, and online. She has been working as a doula in home and hospital births. Rosa's website has been the source of dozens of support groups, many breastfeeding counselors, and IBCLCs, and has helped hundreds of thousands of families around the world get to their maternity goals. For the last few years, she has been very focused in nutrition after a cancer treatment left some serious issues on her health. She's now running a weekly podcast and a video interview to relevant people addressing topics from conception through teens. In February, she will launch a training program to become an IBCLC with the help of several new and experienced IBCLCs that she has been mentoring at a site called Crianza.com. Rosa lives on the beach of Casa de Fels with her two daughters who were homeschooled for 6 years, her lovely husband, and her dog, Timmy. Please welcome Rosa Suarez to the podcast today. Thank you so much for joining me today, Rosa. I'm so excited to talk to you and to learn more about lactation and the tongue tie world and your practice in Spain. I think it's really fascinating to learn how we're all doing the same profession, but in different parts of the world. So first, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
So I'd love to start with learning about how you got into this space. Like, how did you become an IBCLC?
Well, I think that most of us, we started this breastfeeding journey with our children, becoming a mother. So I started about 22 years ago when my eldest daughter was born. And, you know, I wanted to be prepared about what I was going to face, you know, parenting, breastfeeding, sleeping and everything. So when I was 7 months pregnant, I went to a La Leche League meeting, and I was fascinated to see a 2 years old child that was moving around, you know, playing, and suddenly he took off the his mother t-shirt and started nursing, and I was like, "What? I can't believe." So I wanted to learn more and more. So I eventually became not a leader of La Leche League, but something very similar, because I was there all the time and helping our leader and all that. And I also help other groups, not La Leche League, because we have many other groups here in Spain. And then in 2007, I had after I had my second daughter. My second daughter was about a year and a half or so. I had a cervix cancer, and I got all the chemotherapy, radiotherapy, everything. And when I got when the doctor said that I survived, that I was fine, I said, well, what shall I do with the life that has been given to me? So I said, okay, let's do the IBCLC stuff. And so I'm not a nurse or doctor or anything like that. I'm not a healthcare provider. So it was a bit difficult for me at that time. But in 2008, I became IBCLC. So in 2010, I started helping other people to become IBCLC, giving trainings, few personal physical trainings. I mean, I was going to different places to give 2 or 3 days very intensive training, because I wanted other people to know about how to become IBCLC and how to know more about breastfeeding. And a few years ago, when the pandemic started and all that, and some people asked me to give that same training online. And then I thought, wow, that would be really interesting to have then other people that know much more than me giving, specific contents that I'm not as good as they can be. So I created this website at ecrianza.com, which is a platform where we give specific breastfeeding information and to become IBCLC and also to help people to pass the exam, But from 2003, about 2003 until now, and it still runs, I had a website which was one of the most visited websites about children in Spanish around the world. Everything related to breastfeeding, attachment parenting, and all that. And it had three areas. One was documents, information, articles from people from around the world, translated into Spanish or written into Spanish. Another area was a forum. We have to think that there was no Facebook, Instagram, or TikTok, or even YouTube. And we had a very impressive forum with about 50 or now I think we are 70,000 people. And then also a shop, to fund the rest of the things with where we sold baby carriers, cloth nappies, diapers, and things like that, So, but recently, these last 3, 4 years have been more related to how to help other people to become IBCLC and also into my private practice, helping other families with their breastfeeding issues.
Wow, so you really jumped all into lactation. That's amazing. I love hearing other people's stories and how they got into this space because it usually is a very personal one. And I think that some of the, I am an RN based IBCLC. I did, my path was from labor and delivery. And I worked labor and delivery primarily for 15 years, a little bit in the NICU. And I decided to really change paths and focus in on lactation. But I will say some of the absolute best IBCLCs I know are not nurses, were not nurses. They were lay people who had to take all the courses. And I really think that there is so much to be gained that way. I actually think that a lot of times some of the ones that I know who aren't quite as knowledgeable are ones who were able to take very little because of their medical background. And while I agree that, and I understand that a medical background does help, it can, doesn't always, it really doesn't guarantee a whole lot of lactation knowledge, right? So I think it's fantastic to come from outside the medical profession. I think it really
Absolutely.
is be a beautiful way in.
Yeah, and it's good. At the beginning, I was a bit reluctant because I didn't have this medical background. But then, as you said, I met a lot of very, what I said, dame, lactation dames, women that are the top of the top and in many conferences. And they don't have this background either, but they're not less specific and they go to the bottom of the every single thing that they want to encourage people, So I'm really happy about helping also other people to give this other point of view, Because sometimes if you are all the time in the NICU or human milk banks or things like that, then I remember a couple of months ago I spoke with the manager of the human milk banks in the United States and North America and Canada. And I was able to talk to her because I was in the right place and the right moment. And I was able to speak with her about breastfeeding, not about medical condition, but about breastfeeding. I think that I can talk to anybody at the same level. So I think that that's really important to be expert in breastfeeding, not in any other medical or life situation, and that's what I try to be for these years,
Absolutely. And I've been blessed to have three interns, and two of my interns were non-medical people, right? One of them I've been her primary intern, and the other one I was not. But I think that I've seen such passion in them and such real dedication to learning about breastfeeding and really doing everything they can to support dyads. And I, in my time in the hospital, definitely in labor and delivery, I did not see it treated the same, right? It was actually something in the hospital I was in California. You got an extra stipend, an extra $100 a month if you had the IBCLC credential. And so, you know, usually like once a year, there'd be a group that were like, well, let's just go do it because, you know, we know everything that we need to know on it. So we might as well just go get some money. And it was really not treated the same at all in the hospital, especially in the labor floor setting. And it was really unfortunate because when I look back to what I did when I was a labor nurse, it's really not, it's not the same thing at all. It's really, I had no deep understanding. I didn't even, and not even just the fact that now I see older babies, I see a lot of babies in the like 6 to 18 month range. Like I love working with older babies. And I see a lot of 4 to 6 month old too, but I actually don't get early babies all that often, occasionally, and I love them, but I do work with a lot of older babies. So yes, it's different than in the hospital where they're only seeing them. In most of the US, you get 2 days in the hospital when you have a baby. So it is different than that. But even when I think back to the first 2 days in the hospital, I had no understanding of breastfeeding. I had no understanding of a good latch. I had no understanding of reflexive latching and how the baby really knows what to do. You know, I had very classical hospital training of sit the mom up, hold the baby, hold the boob, shove them together. You know, it was definitely not the same respect for the breastfeeding credential in the hospital.
Yeah, I think that at least here, they don't know either, but there's more and more people that have interest on learning more about how to do the right thing. Unfortunately, I think that we have in many places, not just here in Spain, but I think everywhere, that mothers get pushed to breastfeed, but don't have the support to do it well. You know, they don't have this support after leaving the hospital or even while staying at the hospital if the baby is losing weight, too much weight, you know, then they don't have a solution about what, or a look about what's being wrong, what the mother is doing wrong or what the baby is doing wrong and trying to fix it. No, they just give them a bottle and then, well, when you'll be out the hospital, you'll find out how to remove that bottle if you do it, you know. So most of my customers are a few days old babies and families that they just got this extra bottle and they want to remove it. Or they have, you know, sore nipples or mastitis or problems like that, and they don't know what to do. And they've been told to, you know, just to give a bottle and that's all. And nobody tells them nobody sees them as a unit, you know, as a dyad, as a woman and a child and how they interrelate together. And it's not just about the latch. It's about how is the situation in this family, you know, if there's other members of the family that might help or not to succeed in breastfeeding. You know, it's not just about small details. It's about the whole picture, I think. And sometimes healthcare providers are too busy in many other things. And they just have 10 minutes visit. So there's no time to wait for a feed or things like that, you know, or listen to the mother or stay calm and ask the right questions and stay calm for the mother to answer and not being judged.
Absolutely. I think it's wonderful that you get a lot of early babies. I wish that was happening. You know, I think when we get them in the first few weeks, there's so many more options available to them, right? Absolutely. It's so much easier to fix. I mean, it really applies to so much of life and health and everything. The earlier you find a problem and work towards a solution, the easier it's going to be, right? When you've been doing something, you know, a certain way that's not the best for, you know, weeks, months, or years, it's harder to change it. So I think it's wonderful when you get babies that are early. I think part of the problem in the US is the whole insurance system. And it's a big issue. And it tends to be that there is this general divide that if you're really low income,
you actually can get pretty decent support. We have these programs called WIC, the Women, Infants, and Children in the U.S., and they have peer counselors and lactation consultants. They're more supportive of breastfeeding, and there's more help available. And if you're a higher income, you can afford to pay someone, or you have better insurance and you might not even need to pay. It's the middle people. It's the middle class who are stuck in the middle, who are working, and they frequently have insurance, but their insurance doesn't cover it, or nobody accepts their insurance because their insurance pays so poorly and they don't have the money to pay privately. So it's a lot of families that are stuck in the middle. And so they wait and they try to figure it out themselves. And then unfortunately, it just gets worse and worse, right? And then it's harder when they do finally go for help. So I think that's part of why in the US, a lot of times we see people getting support later. You know, if you're going to try to figure it out yourself if you have to pay for it. And so I think that that unfortunately is a big issue for families in the US. And breastfeeding is not universally supported here, right? Actually, just this morning, a colleague sent me a pamphlet that she found from the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry. And it was just a little flyer to be put in pediatricians' offices about, you know, when the kiddo should start, when a baby should start getting their teeth brushed, when they should go to the dentist, very basic form. And about halfway in, all of a sudden there's a line that says, when the first teeth erupt, make sure to wean from breastfeeding.
Oh, no.
And I was like, wait, they're actually publishing this? This is insane. And they're actually telling families this. It was so there's just not the support and the education that there should be in the U.S.
No, not at all. Well, here we don't have these pamphlets, but I think that most of the pediatricians would agree with this pamphlet that you're mentioning, because there's no knowledge about breastfeeding and especially teething. And also with complementary feeding and all that, I just wrote an article for a magazine about the new guidelines from the WHO for complementary feeding. And, you know, it was for a magazine that most of the people are vegan or vegetarian. And they were like, what? What are the WHO saying that children should eat animal source food since 6 months? What? No way. And I said, well, don't shoot the messenger. That's what they say. It's not me. They say this because it's the only way that they can get enough nutrient-dense food. So it's really difficult to transfer the knowledge about breastfeeding and all that area to the right people, not to pediatricians and pediatric nurses. That's why I'm trying, you know, to foster, to help those that really want to know how can they get this information in the most efficient way, you know, that they can study and learn and get their data. Here at the IBCLC, credentials are not as important as or as known as in the US, because most of the nurses or pediatricians, they don't even know what an IBCLC is. So it's and they don't get more money, and they don't get paid more, or even most of them hospitals, they don't know that they have an IBCLC working there. So it's just because they want to know and they want to have this credential. But most of the people that get it, it's because it's something personal, something that you really want to have as to credit what you know, what you've been studying so much.
Yeah, I think one of the issues we have in the U.S. actually, and I don't know if this is an issue for you, is that there are a lot of credentials that sound a lot like the IBCLC. So there is in lactation, we have, you know, we could have a CBS, a certified breastfeeding specialist. We could have a CBE, a certified breastfeeding educator, a CLC, a certified lactation counselor. And there's two others that I'm forgetting right now. And so it's very confusing for families when, you know, they hear IBCLC, and a lot of times they'll hear then CLC, and they think that they're the same, which is a very valid point, right? They sound very similar, but there's a massive difference.
I don't know what would be the similarity in the US, but it would be something like la leche leak. You know that
yeah,
there's
we have La Leche League.
it's something similar to La Leche League, but it's not attached to this the La Leche League rules. So it's about if a person, it might be a doctor, it might be a mother that has a group, and then she starts with some friends, usually other mothers, and they have mother groups, and then sometimes they create an association, and then they have, you know, these internal rules, and also they have training, internal training, and things like that, and they become part of a federation of groups, breastfeeding groups in Spain. And so they also have a congress. This federation has a yearly congress, and they get specific trainings to become this sort of leaders, you know, this sort of, it's not consultant, it's more like assistant, you know. And they know a lot about breastfeeding, sometimes much more than nurses or pediatric nurses or midwives or even doctors, because they work with mothers all the time, and their work is voluntary. They don't get paid for that. It's like a literally that you don't get paid to hold the group. You know, it's very similar to that. And then we have this sort of person, which is called asesora. And then there is the IBCLC. I mean, many non-health people, you know, nurses and midwives or pediatricians or whatever, come from these groups, you know, like me in my case, you know, and many other, my colleague Laura López Fuentes, who is my colleague in this platform, Crianza. She's an architect. My background is in computer science, and her background is in architecture. But she also has a group where mothers come every week or every 2 weeks for free, and she helps them. She doesn't get any money for that. It just, and I don't get any money if anybody comes to my group. But if somebody wants me to go to their place, or they want to come to my office, and I have to stay 2 hours just dedicated to them, then they have to pay, you know. But if it's for a group and they come many with many other families, that's free, that's for free. And sometimes here, I think that they start very at the beginning, because they know for social network or whatever, that if they have any problem, they can go to the group. But if they want to have somebody specific to come to their house and to be more professional, they have to hire an IBCLC, you know. So that's the difference. And now we are quite a lot in Spain. I don't remember exactly the name, but it's quite impressive. It's really big.
Yeah, we actually don't really have a lot of the groups, honestly, definitely not in the states that I've been in. I'm not saying that some states in the U.S. don't, but in California and in Washington, neither of the areas that I've been in have we had an active La Leche League. There's no La Leche League within probably more than 100 miles of me that I know of. And we don't have a lot of support groups. Like I said, there's that WIC for the low income, but there aren't just general support groups or, you know, free support groups around very often. It's a pretty rare thing. And so it does leave families to either, if the hospital they delivered at or live near has an outpatient clinic, sometimes they will go and do that. Those are rare. A few hospitals around have them, but it's not very common. And even then, they're still used to only seeing pretty new babies. And then private practice, that's really it. I think the lower credentials in the US are because a lot of healthcare providers tack them on. And most of the lower credentials, like a CLC and a CBE, all of those are about a 45-hour training at most, a couple of weekends. They're not in depth, and they're not definitely nothing like the IVCLC. So it's a very different outlook, but it does. Then there's a lot of offices that will then say, oh, we have a lactation specialist here, right? We have an LC, they'll call it sometimes, you know? So it just abbreviates the CLC, but it misrepresents what they're doing and their knowledge. And it's very confusing for families.
Yeah. Anyway, I must say that It's been really different at the IBCLC when I, at least the exam, for instance, this, I passed the exam twice, the first time on 2008 and the second on 2018. And I can say it was easier, but I think that the IBLC has changed and made it easier to become IBCLC. So I know some IBCLCs in Spain that I think they shouldn't be IBCLC because they either don't have them, or it, not just in Spain, also in other countries in Europe, at least I know in Europe, because they do things that they shouldn't do. You know, it's not on the scope of practice, or it's something that it shouldn't be this way. But I don't know if it's the way the Europeans work or whatever. That, and nowadays, when I started to be, I started the IBCLC accreditation, I had to pass the exam at least every 10 years. Now you just have to pass it once. And every 5 years, you just say that you've been to different trainings or congresses or whatever, and you get renewed. But I think that's really bad. I think it's very, very bad, because when you have to pass the exam again, wow, gosh, you have to study, you know, and you have to put your batteries again and start to take, you know, courses or, but seriously, you know, not just being there listening, and if you keep something in your mind, that's great. But no, you have to work much harder if you have to pass an exam. And I think that this change in the IBLC stuff has not been really good. No, I don't think. And I think that they've done it because what you said, because there are so many other credentials in the United States. In fact, I think that the IBLC wanted to create another intermediate accreditation. And most of the IBCLCs said, no, don't do it. I mean, it's going to be much worse. And sometimes I know that in not just in the United States, I know in other countries, I teach in Poland and in Portugal. And I know that in both countries, they have their own CLCs, you know, because they don't want to be, they want to have something local. And sometimes it's also confusing for the Polish or Portuguese nurses or even mothers, you know, because they don't really know the difference between one and the other. And I'm not saying that one is better than the other, not at all, but it's confusing. Yeah,
I think what's different too, and I don't know how it is in the rest of the world, is that in the medical world here, you never retake your boards. So a doctor would never retake their boards, an MD, an ND, a nurse practitioner, a nurse. I was an RN for 15 years. I never retook my boards. I still carry my RN license, even though I don't work as a direct patient care registered nurse. I still carry my license for 24 years and I've never retaken my boards. And in a lot of ways, that would be incredibly difficult to retake my boards, right? Because I had, even when I was in the hospital still, I had super specialized into labor and delivery. Yeah. I was not practicing any cardiac or any neuro or any GI stuff. Like I was not, that wasn't my area anymore. So I think that's one of the differences. And I don't know if the IBCLE is looking at it from a US perspective, but even things like lawyers here, they don't retake their bar exam, and none of the medical professionals retake their boards. I think the bigger issue is they need to actually be looking at the continuing ed, right? And they need to really be evaluating that. You know, we have to get 75 units every 5 years, which is very minimal. I renewed in 2021, in December of 21. And in the first 3 months of 2022, I had already done 65 units. I had a really wonderful big class I was taking. I have never been close to my units. I take so many classes, it's ridiculous. I kind of stop keeping track and writing down the number sometimes. I keep track of the courses, but it's like I don't always know the number because there's just so much. And yet I know other LCs, other lactation consultants, who one of them reached out on a group recently, has been a lactation consultant for 20 years, and said her license was up for renewal you know, within the next month, and where could she get some free units? And I said, well, how many do you need? Thinking she needed, you know, like she was two or three short. She said she needed 75. And I said, you've had 5 years and you haven't taken a single class.
Yeah.
I said, I can't even talk to you about this. I'm like, I don't even know how to answer that. Like,
yeah, I had the same problem because in our platform, we have many small trainings for nowadays when an IBCLC has to renew after 5 years, we have to pass self-evaluating test, you know, and then that test tells us or should tell, but I don't think it's a good test, but well, that's something personal. Right. I was very happy to have this self-evaluation test because I thought, wow, I work so hard teaching about breastfeeding that I want to know exactly what are my areas of failure, the areas that I need to improve, you know, but the exam was, you know, so weird that it didn't fulfill that interest. But the idea of that test is that then they tell you which areas you need more training about. So we created specific tests to cover these seven areas. And as you say, I just got a call from a woman that said, well, I don't have almost any of the 75 SERPs. And I was like, what? I have almost 500.
Right? It's alarming. And I think that's the bigger issue.
I know 500 is a lot, but you know, 75, it's just 15 every year. It's nothing.
It's barely anything. Honestly, our requirement is pretty low, and it's very astounding when you meet people who can't even do that. It's so minimal. And to me, it says that they really don't care about learning anymore. And I think it's one of those things that can happen across the board in professions, right? I mean, I remember when my oldest was in third grade, her teacher had been teaching for 25 years. And, you know, my daughter wasn't quite getting some of the material as well. And I went in and talked to her about it. And she said, well, this is the way I've been teaching it for 25 years. I'm not going to change anything now. She's like, there is nothing new out there that I need to learn. And all I could think was, so you don't ever adapt and change? We're not changing or learning anything for 25 years. And I've seen the same thing in doctors, and I've seen the same thing in lawyers.
Yeah.
And you know, all professions, unfortunately, have people who either don't put in the effort or burn out. But I've routinely said to people, I said, when I stop learning, that's when I need to leave this profession. Like when I lose my passion and my wonder, my curiosity, and my desire to do better, then I shouldn't be doing this anymore.
I can understand that, for instance, now it's the cold season, you know, everybody has flu or a COVID or like that. And I can understand that when you're a nurse or a pediatrician, 95% of your patients will be, you know, just because they have a fever or whatever, and you are going to prescribe every day exactly the same, you know. But you have to live for the other 5%, you know, the things that might be different, and you might change the life of that family or that person, you know. But I see many, many people that they got stalled in their everyday world, and they don't change anything because their life doesn't change, or they think that it doesn't change. It's always the same, and they don't realize that things change, and there's a lot of progress. There's a lot of investigations, a lot of people doing things differently. I do something that I really like. It's really stressing, but I really like, which is translating conferences from Australia. There's a woman called Barbara Glare that she has a website called Breastfeeding Conferences. And she makes lots of very, very interesting conferences. And we've been for 2 or 3 years now translating into Spanish and dubbing some of her conferences. And there's so much, many new things that you would never think about that now people are working to, you know, to fix mastitis, to fix sore nipples, to fix, or even I saw a conference that I was so astonished, and she didn't say anything new, but the way she said how the latch should be done, it was so open-minding, you know, my eyes opened wide. And I thought, Rosa, you already know all that. But it was the way that she presented it, how the chin has to touch the breast, and then the head goes back. And then, you know, all these small reflexes that arise. And if the baby does these steps one after the other. And it was like, wow, that's marvelous. That's perfect. And I've tried that with some of my patients, and it's been mind-blowing.
Right.
And I already knew that. I already knew that. I didn't learn anything not new. But it was the way that she presented it. It was extraordinary. And I think that people might do things, or might think that they do things right in their day-by-day working life, but you can always improve. And improving, it's, you know, so rewarding, so happy, you know, because you see that things are getting better faster, and people are then happier. So if you can make somebody happier, wow, that's godsend, you know, that's really good.
I agree. And I actually took a reflexive latching course last year from Avery Young, and it was mind-blowing as well, because it was, again, all things I knew. I knew all the reflexes. I just had never seen them put together in that way and shown how it can work. It was like taking, in a way, it was almost like listening to different instruments or listening to them together in a symphony. Like, it was so different. It was like I knew all the elements, but the way that it had been presented, the way that it had been shown to put together, it was such a beautiful thing. And I think that's the gift of learning. And I think that's the gift of other professionals and other people still striving to do better as well, because we all see things and learn things differently. And it can make such a difference to, you know, hear someone else's point of view. And there's so many different things that we can learn about. One of the things that I know that you took was the IBCLC masterclass, right? When did you take that?
That was, I think it was 3 years ago. Yeah.
Okay. So right around, I was going to say that's, I think I took it in 2020. So right around then. Yeah. And did you do the online version, or was there an in-person?
I live in Barcelona, so for me it was impossible to go there. Yeah.
Now, there have been some courses that have been out of the US, but not since COVID, right? COVID has changed a lot of things.
Yeah, and I think that COVID was really good for some things, because then some trainings that were not able to take it online, then they made an effort, and then they made it available for other people that were not able to go. In fact, there's been some, I just checked, and I did it in May 22. Yeah. And I've seen some conferences or trainings that during the pandemic were able to access online, because otherwise there was no chance to have them. And after the pandemic, they moved to only present. And it's awful, because I can't go to Panama or you know, or San Diego or other places in the world. It's too much money for me, and also time and all that. I know it's nicer to be with people and talk and have coffee and dinner and all that, but there are so many conferences and trainings that I'm missing, because they just went back to in person, and I can't go. No.
I agree. The in-person classes can be wonderful, and I have really enjoyed when I've been able to do them. But if I could only take in person, I would have, you know, a quarter of the education I do, right?
Yeah.
Because it's been amazing to be able to take classes that I wanted to that were far away, or that, you know, sometimes they're just an on-demand class. It's just listed, and people like the masterclass now, you could go and take it now, or someone else could take it next month or the following month. Like, it's easier sometimes to fit in your schedule too. You know, you don't have to necessarily take off a week of work to go do this. You can work on it, you know, a couple of hours each week and get it done over time. So it definitely makes a difference. And there are some courses I think that are nice. I took a hands-on course with Jennifer Toe last, a little over a year ago now. It was a lactation consultant and body workers working together and how we can co-treat. And that was really wonderful in a hands-on class because it was about, so much of it was the manual therapy, and not for me to do the manual therapy, but understanding and watching how what they do affected what I do, right? And mm-hmm. So that was really beneficial. But so many of my other courses that I have taken have all been virtual because it works, right? We can fit it into our lives. And I think that's made a big difference here. A lot of the classes are still being offered virtual. I mean, some places are going back to just in person, but a lot of them are doing a combination, right?
Also for people like me that English is not my mother language, sometimes it's easier to stop and I didn't understand what you said. Just go back or, just with your mobile. I have some British or American friends, and I call them and I ask them, what do you think she's saying here? Mm-hmm. And things like that, because then you miss this when you're alive, you know, because if you don't understand at that very same moment, then it's lost.
Right.
And online, for me at least, is easier to, you know, focus the attention on that lesson and then write down. And if I didn't understand, then rewind and listen it again, or, you know, stop it a bit and then translate what she said and do my writings. And I'm the old-fashioned way, still with pen and paper and all that, you know. But I need, you know, this time to stop and write down what she said and write down in my own language and then go back. So for me, online is easier this way because I can understand better what the teacher is saying. And nowadays we have so much, you know, Instagram emails or Facebook or whatever, that you can write an email or whatever to the teacher and ask him or her, what do you meant with this? And I didn't understand, or I think you're wrong. I've been helping also people from GOLD conferences, you know, to help them to get some questions when I was watching their conferences online and live, or even with their forums, asking questions to the people that are presenting, you know, the teachers, you know, I don't remember now the name, person presenters, I'm missing out the name, the teachers, you know, and I think that that's really interesting, because sometimes when you are in a life situation, you're so embedded that it's sometimes you don't see exactly, you don't get the whole picture, as I say, you know. And then it's like, okay, he's saying this. I remember in one conference that there was a woman that was saying, oh, you have the same amount of iron in a steak than in portion of a spinach. And I thought, no way. No, it's not possible. So I asked her and she said, rubbish, I mean, sorry about that, but she said a stupid thing. And then I asked her again, no, please tell me if you made a mistake, I understand, because it's really confusing, but no, it's not possible. Or in another conference, there was a woman that was talking about allergies, and I just had a conference at the Baby Friendly Hospital Initiative conference in the UK that was also online. And there was a person, a professor, that was explaining about the Delphi protocol, which is outstanding about these allergies and all that. And she explained a lot of ideas about this allergy situation and breastfeeding and all that, but she was not considering the Delphi protocol. And that's the only protocol that it's not related to the industry. And that woman was an IBCLC, and she should know about this Delphi protocol. And she should have said, I'm sorry, but the only information that I've got is industry related. So you have to take this information with, I think you say, with a bit of salt. I know that it's not everything accurate as I would like. But she didn't say that. She said like that was worlds from carved in stone. And I was, no way, you know. And so this online environment also helps you to dip into that information and ask back to the teacher, to the speaker, and develop a bit more about what the speaker said. And I think that I've been a speaker in many conferences, and I think that this is what I really like when people ask me difficult questions.
Right. And I will say too, I took Jennifer's gut health class, and I watched that two or three times. I paused and I went back, and it was so much information. If I had taken that in person, I would have not learned nearly what I did, because I had to go slower. I had to re-listen to it. I had to try to understand. And that is the benefit of these online options, you know. But I did want to ask some of the kind of the differences between how tongue tie is assessed and the culture and the treatment in the US and versus Spain. And while obviously there are going to be differences throughout each country, right? And one part of Spain is not the same as another, and same in the US, we have, you know, a lot of different areas and different cultures here. But in general, in the US, I would say pediatricians are still not assessing or noticing tongue tie. ENTs are still coming out across the board against it. They're still largely released by pediatric dentists. And I would say the biggest issue we have right now, or at least I feel that we have, is babies going and getting released without any functional assessment. You know, a lot of them are literally showing pictures in a Facebook group, having other parents or interesting provider saying, yes, your baby has a tie, and then looking up the best provider online near them and going and getting it released and then not getting a good result. That is becoming quite commonplace here. I get multiple clients a month who have already had the release completely unsupported, and not surprisingly to me, right, did not have a good result. So that is very commonplace here. What is the climate like in Spain for a tongue tie?
Well, it depends. We have more and more pediatricians that have been trained about how to identify and also how to have a very small release of the tie, not the deep release, but the more superficial release. And we have more and more surgeons, pediatric surgeons, that know how to do it, and have also IBCLCs or breastfeeding experts or people with years of knowledge about breastfeeding next to them to assess. But we have also many, many people, IBCLCs and pediatricians and everything, that say that that's fate, and that's not really the issue, because that's true. I mean, in many cases, just fixing the latch, it's okay. In many cases, when I have people coming to my office, or I go to their houses, and the first thing I ask them is, show me how you do it. And it's terribly wrong. And sometimes just allowing them to, you know, to do what I said before, helping the reflexes work together, not against nature, but helping them to process freely, then the latch is correct and everything is fine. But many times then when I put the finger, you know, very carefully and with all the conscious and permissions from the baby and all that, I see a very, very bad sac from the baby. And then that has to be fixed. I mean, it's not just about breastfeeding. It's about life. I mean, I had my tongue tied released just a few months ago, and I'm 58. So I really know what are the issues when you don't have your tongue tie release when it should be. So I explained to the family that sometimes their pain goes away when the latch is correct, but the baby is not getting enough food because the baby is not able to do it. But many pediatricians or other people, they just get this, oh, okay, that was just the latch issue and a problem resolved. And it's not like that. I mean, it's not just a cut it or not cut it, or just having a support or a good latch or not having. It's, I think, and I learned that also in this IBCLC masterclass, that it's, everything is much more complex, and you have to see what I say, the whole picture, that the what the mother has been gone through and what is her expectations and when what she's able to go through also. You know, because having this tongue tie cut, it's not so easy. Sometimes you have to go to do some exercises previous and after. And, you know, it's not a nice path. And you have to see sometimes in which point they are and in which point they want to be. And I think that many people around Spain, there's a lot of confusion about whether the exercises are needed or not. Many people say they're not needed at all, which I think it's terrible advice. And some other people say that you shouldn't touch the baby's mouth because you're intruding something sacred, you know, like, no, that's not a virgin. I mean, no, please. If you don't do it, consequences will be much harder. And I know it in my own body, you know, but there's a lot of confusion already still in many, many people. And there's a lot of very people that have a very powerful voice that they say that tongue tie is not needed in many, many cases. And I don't think that, I mean, we still have a lot of road to go to define, but it's not just in Spain. I think that it's everywhere that we need to have this good teamwork, you know, an IBCLC or CLC, whatever, somebody that can hold this family and take. And there's also something that I teach in my classes, that we are talking a lot about a multidisciplinary team. But I think that instead of having the family go to the surgeon, to the pediatrician, to the IBCLC, to the, you know, the pediatric nurse, you know, different people, the physiotherapist, all these multidisciplinary heads, the family should go only to one, say IBCLC, say the pediatrician, say whoever. They should only talk to one person, and this person should tell them, okay, if this is your target, if this is what you want to do, if express and feeding the baby with finger feeding or whatever, it's okay for you, then let's go this way. But there should be somebody that help them, not, you know, being the family's issue to go to different people, you know. It's like when I had the cancer, I had to go, you know, to have my chemotherapy, my radiotherapy, my medicines. But I was always talking to one doctor. I didn't talk to first, I talked to many doctors, but there was only one doctor who was the head of my medical situation. And I think that in this environment, we should have also just one head that the family talks to. And then they go to the physiotherapist or whoever. But it's nowadays it's so complex, you know. There are so many heads around, and family get really, really confused because everybody says different things, and online they find, you know, somebody that says this and somebody other says the other things, the opposite, and it's really confusing for the families. And also, additionally, and I think that this happens also in the United States and even more, is that the solution in one place might not be the same as in another place because the resources are not the same. For instance, here in Barcelona, we have a very, very good tongue tie professionals. surgeons, physiotherapists, and pediatricians. And I have a bunch of people that are really, really good about what they do. But when they, I have a telehealth online consultation from other place in the world, sometimes they don't have these tools. So you have, as IBCLC, you have to deal with what you have, you know. So it's not always easy to find a solution for a given problem.
I agree. I think it's a really complicated thing. And I had my tie released as an adult just a little over a year ago when I was 44. And it made a big difference for me, right? My kids were released when they were 10 and 13 because I didn't know when they were babies. And what I frequently tell parents too is this: breastfeeding is important, right? I'm not trying to minimize breastfeeding, but when a parent says to me, well, what if I just pump, or what if I just skip the baby bottles, right? I say, this is about airway health for life. This is about your baby's tongue moving correctly. This is about them feeling good in their body. This is about more than the breastfeeding relationship for the next couple of years. And while that is really important, it's also important to understand that it is about their airway development for life. And that is so crucial in the first 6 years of life that it really matters what we do, really matters where that tongue rests and everything. So it's a pretty challenging thing here. And I do agree. I think it would be nice, like you said, with, you know, with your cancer treatment, how you had one kind of like central person managing everything. And it would be definitely easier on families if they had their IBCLC centrally managing everything. And that's definitely my goal with my clients, is I help, you know, I will communicate with the release provider and the body worker and talk to them about what I see and what's going on, and really try to coordinate care so that they're getting the best result and so that the families are not needing to, like, I would never say to a family, oh, you should go get body work, go find someone, right? Like, that's not how you really support a family, especially we're talking about new parents, sleep deprived, struggling with feeding. They don't need another thing like that on their list of, well, how do I know if someone's good? Well, who should I go to? So coordinating care is a big part of managing tongue tie, really, and supporting that family to make it as easy as possible and to get them the best result without needing to see. I mean, sometimes I see people who've seen so many. They've seen an OT and a PT and a chiropractor and a, you know, massage therapist and a craniosacral and a pediatric dentist. And they've seen just an SLP. They've seen so many people, but frequently what's lacking is lactation. And they've had too many, nobody managing, nobody looking at it all and saying, okay, what's really necessary in this and what isn't? And when you have too many opinions and too many perspectives, it can be really overwhelming for families.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So I think that you're right. Tongue tie in the world has a long way to go. I think I got so hopeful when Brazil had done their year where they were assessing tongue tie on every baby, but that was back in what, like 2015 or something. And I thought that that was going to be a big tipping point. I thought that that would really help the world look at tongue tie differently. And I'm sure it helped some, not to the extent that I had hoped. So I think there's still a lot more education to go on this and just getting the knowledge out there to especially in the hospitals and in pediatricians' offices, right? That's where we need that front line of people being able to say, even just being able to say, well, I don't know much about this, but I know that something seems like you should see an expert, right? This isn't my area. Here's an expert to go see. If we could start getting families getting recognized for their ties earlier, I think it would make a big difference.
Yeah, I think so. But I had a good discussion about this with one of my teachers in my training. And she's a pediatrician in Pamplona. And she doesn't like to do it the very first day. She wants to expect if the problem is very evident, you know, if you have a very tight tongue or you know, something that you see that really is not elastic and it's that it won't change, then that's correct. Obviously, she will do it as soon as possible. But she says that sometimes you have to wait and see how this is going to affect and how the tongue is going to move. And I don't have as much experience as she has, you know, working every day with children. And sometimes she says that she doesn't like to cut. and then she tries not to do it if it's not absolutely necessary. And I think that sometimes that's, you know, this rope game, you know, that breastfeeding pulls from one side and the resistance from the pediatrician resists from the other side. And then it's, you know, this sort of game of who falls first, you know, if breastfeeding is in jeopardy, or the pediatrician is able to cut or derive this family to get the treatment. And I think that that's the problem, because here we have I guess everywhere a lot of egos and a lot of people that say that they really know what to do. And many times the reality is much more interesting than difficult.
Absolutely. I think that's a big thing, is there's too many egos getting in this. And we need to all remember that the goal, hopefully, that all of us have at that center is supporting families and helping them get the right expert for them at that moment. And that's one of the benefits of telehealth, right? Is being able to work with someone from farther away. But I just think that we need to put those aside and really focus on getting the families the support they need to get through this. So I think that's, unfortunately, I'd love to hear that it wasn't an issue over there, but I think that unfortunately is kind of a worldwide issue right now with getting tongue-tie support with the families, that they need it at the right time and the right expert. So I'm definitely watching to see what happens. And I think that it'll be interesting to see in the next couple of years, as tongue-tie knowledge gets spread and as more providers are taking courses. And I know that there's definitely still more of those who are against it, but I'm definitely interested to see how this is going to go and where it's going to develop. So I'm going to continue watching and seeing how it goes in Spain. And I'm finding it so interesting to watch tongue-tie around the world. And I just also want to say thank you so much for your time today. I know it's very valuable and you have a lot going on with a new course starting tomorrow, because you work with so many aspiring IBCLCs. So I just really want to thank you for your time today to take out and discuss this with me.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for your work also with this podcast.
Thank you. I just hope to share information with providers everywhere so that we can all learn from each other.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
When you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change you. I hope that you enjoyed the podcast today and learned something new. If you know someone who would benefit from this podcast, please share it.